to the Second Court of Appeals this afternoon. We have two cases on our docket for argument this afternoon and several other cases that will be submitted today without argument. Our first case, I believe, is Continental Casualty Insurance Company versus Mary Lavender. If our clerk will announce counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Daryl Severa to argue for appellant and Mr. Chris Morris to argue for appellee.
Afternoon, Your Honor.
Good afternoon. Mr. Severa, you may proceed.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. As the court is well aware, this is an appeal from a no-evidence motion for summary judgment concerning the existence or non-existence of a common-law marriage. Continental Casualty is a workers' compensation insurance carrier. A brief summary of the facts. Mr. Lavender was a technician for TK Elevators. He had an accident October 9th of 2000. It resulted in his death. Initially, there was a dispute as to whether or not he was intoxicated. The commission found that he was owed benefits. Continental Casualty started paying benefits. In Texas, death benefits are payable to a spouse and to children. In this case, there were no children of the marriage. The benefits are payable until there is death or remarriage. In 2008, Continental, after doing an investigation, filed a dispute with the Workers' Compensation Commission asserting that, in essence, Ms. Lavender was living in a common-law marriage and therefore was remarried under the statute and no longer entitled to death benefits. The matter went to the Workers' Compensation Commission. They found that she was still entitled. My client appealed to the district court in Denton County. That was filed in August of 2009. September 24th of 2009, they filed a no-evidence MSJ. Subsequently, there was also an award of attorney's fees, as the court is aware, that was contested and appealed. So basically, we have 8 points of appeal. Points of errors 1, 2, and 3 really address the no-evidence MSJ on the common-law marriage. Points 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 address the attorney fee issues. So as the court is aware, the bottom line is there a scintilla of evidence and the summary judgment evidence that was presented to the court, and deposition testimony and documents, et cetera. As the court is aware, more than a scintilla of evidence exists when evidence supporting that finding as a whole would enable a reasonable and fair-minded person to differ in their conclusions. Likewise, the review standard on a summary judgment is that you're going to look at everything in the light most favorable to the non-movement, indulging every reasonable inference and resolving any doubts against the movement. So let us address the points of error. Point of error number one, that really addresses the agreement to be married. The court is aware of Section 2.401A2 in Texas. Parties agree to be married, cohabitate in Texas, and represent to others that they are married. The existence of common law marriage has been held by the Supreme Court to be a question of fact. It's not a question of law. Elements concerning the existence of common law marriage can be established by circumstantial evidence, acts, statements, conduct of the parties.
Well, what evidence did you come forward with that there was an agreement to be presently married?
In the deposition testimony and the workers' compensation testimony of Mary Lavender, she described that she and Mr. Brashear were agreed to be married. The terminology she uses, we agreed to be engaged. But that act or conduct was, he gave me the ring, I knew he wanted to marry me, I accepted, and that was in 2002. In February 2003, they moved in together and have continued to live with each other and cohabitate since that time. Now, at least one court, Curtis versus Anderson, has held that the mere fact of giving the ring and acceptance of that ring is an agreement to be married. Now, that is why I think the
prospectively to be married.
And the statute is phrased in terms of agree to be married. It doesn't say presently or currently. The statute under 204 simply states the man and woman agree to be married.
Well, you're not trying to tell us if you give somebody an engagement ring, you're married for purposes of this statute.
No, I don't think that one item in and of itself. But what the courts have said is, well, you have to look at all of the evidence as a whole and say a fact finder, has the right to decide based on the facts presented to them and the evidence presented to them, they had an agreement to be married.
But a no-evidence summary judgment, all summary judgments mean that there's no disputed issues of fact. I mean, I don't think you can circumvent a no-evidence summary judgment by saying it's a fact question. I think that you have to come forward with more than a scintilla of evidence that they had a present agreement to be married. And if that's in the record, then we need to know that.
Well, I will acknowledge to the court, I don't think, granted, we've done discovery in two depositions and the case wasn't even set for trial, that there's testimony that says we have a present intent or agreement to be married. In fact, all the cases cited, I don't think you'll find that in any of the appellate cases listed. They talk about the conduct of the parties, and can you infer from the conduct of the parties that they had an agreement to be married? And that's a fact issue for a jury to listen to and consider, did they have an agreement to be married? And that's what, I mean, our purpose of appealing this is, the court granted no evidence motion for summary judgment when there was, I believe, more than a scintilla of evidence combined with all the other summary judgment evidence for a fact finder to make a decision on whether or not there was an agreement to be married. I mean, otherwise, you know, the courts have consistently held common law marriage as a fact question. And you can infer an agreement to be married from cohabitation and holding out to others. And that's been held by Russell and Gessel.
Why don't we talk about holding out to others?
So, with regard to the second point, cohabitation, I don't think there's any dispute that after February 23rd, they cohabitated. They didn't have relations with anyone else. They've lived together, et cetera. Point of error number three, with regard to holding out, again, the courts have held that holding out can be established by the conduct of the parties. And here, the summary judgment evidence established a summary. I'll list some of the high points. Both are named as insureds on policies. Both named as additional insureds. Lavender's personal checking account, Brashia is the POD beneficiary on her checking account. On her life insurance policies, Brashia is the beneficiary on life insurance policies over and above her sister. Her sister is a contingent beneficiary. Mr. Brashia is the primary beneficiary. Lavender is listed as a beneficiary on Brashia's life insurance policy. They've continuously cohabited together since 2003, traveling together, taking vacations together. The summary judgment evidence also establishes if you want to call it traditional marriage, and if you look back at the tasks generally of what a wife may do, such as cooking, cleaning, things of that nature, she's testified that's what she does. He's testified to more traditional roles of a male may take on, which are taking care of the house, taking care of the outside.
Well, why don't we do things more important, like look back at the life insurance policy. How did she denominate her status? Single?
I don't know.
Well, I'm reading from opposing counsel's brief. So
right.
It says, for example, they each identified themselves as single on insurance policy applications.
Okay.
Well, okay. Seems like that significantly trumps whether you're the beneficiary or not.
Well, but that's a fact issue, I believe. One thing for a jury to consider to determine, are they holding themselves out as husband and wife and looking at their conduct of how they're living and how they're proceeding with their life.
Couldn't the same argument be made for any two people that are cohabitating and have no agreement to be married? I mean, I'm not...
Well,
there has to be some affirmative holding out as husband and wife.
And the Supreme Court in Winfield, and I think in Russell and Gessel, if I'm pronouncing correctly, have said that can all be established by the conduct of the parties. But that's for a jury to decide that, not to be decided on a no-evidence motion for summary judgment, because all these things taken as a whole, a juror could say, listen, I think they had an agreement to be married. I think they cohabitated. I think they held themselves out as husband and wife by their conduct and actions. And that we're not here having tried the case, having a jury verdict as to the existence or non-existence of common law marriage. And so that's
why. I think the problem is there's not one single piece of evidence that I saw, subject to you correcting me, where they told anybody or put in writing they were married. They always were single. They said they were single on their income tax returns. We don't have one witness here, like we normally do, where would come in and say, oh, yeah, she would introduce herself as my husband, this is my wife, we're married, nothing, zero, nada.
Well, we also have, I mean, there is testimony that she was aware that he made representations that it was our property.
But not my wife.
No, I acknowledge that.
I mean, you can buy, you and your cohabitator, or you and your sister, of course, can go buy a piece of property.
Sure, absolutely. But that is a factor to be considered by a jury in reaching that decision.
There has to be something that a jury could at least draw an inference from.
Well,
and I'm not seeing that the inference from any of the evidence that you've mentioned, that the inference that they are married is any stronger than the inference that they are not.
You make a great point, Your Honor. That's a factual dispute to be resolved by a jury.
No, because all no evidence motions for summary judgment resolve facts. There, when there are no facts, the burden is on the non-movement to come forward with more than a scintilla of evidence. So there has to be a scintilla of evidence in the record, not equal inferences going either way. Equal inferences going either way won't defeat a no evidence motion for summary judgment.
Well, I think the cases, the Supreme Court and the appellate courts have said all these factors that we've talked about and that is in the summary judgment evidence are factors that can be considered by a jury to determine whether or not they had the agreement to be married, whether or not they cohabitated, and whether or not they're holding themselves out as husband and wife.
Do any of these cases present a situation where there is no documentation and no verbalization at all that this is my wife, this is my husband, or we're married? Because that's what we have here. We have a bunch of surmises.
Well,
and our trouble is, do three surmises add up to more than a scintilla? Or do you need exactly one solid piece of evidence, just one time, where she said, I want to introduce you to my husband? Okay, now we've got one piece of solid evidence that they're married, not a bunch of surmises.
Well, in the normal scenario of the existence or non-existence of common law marriage, there's generally some sort of financial motive on one side or the other. In other words, you've got someone who's wanting to claim a common law marriage or someone who wants to say, I don't have a common law marriage. Generally, if it's for community assets, if it's a wrongful death suit, whatever it may be. In this case, it's different. And it's different because both of them have a financial interest to deny the existence of a common law marriage. And it's in the summary judgment evidence that they testified that they talked about that they're going to claim that there's no common law marriage so they can continue to collect workers' compensation benefits. And that's in the record. So there is not one specific item. However, the summary judgment evidence as a whole could lead a reasonable-minded juror to differ on the opinions. To differ. Is there an agreement to be married? Is there cohabitation? Are they holding themselves out as husband and wife? In addition, the summary judgment established that they started a company together. And I understand that's not proof of marriage. However, when you're 51% owner of the company and you don't know how much that company makes and how much money it disperses and you trust that other person 100% according to her testimony with the company, that I would submit is not a normal business relationship. That is something, again, that a jury could consider to say, you know what? They're basically living as husband and wife, and I understand they want to claim that there's no common law marriage, but I believe there is sufficient evidence to, or more than a scintilla, to warrant reversal of the summary judgment. With regard to the attorney's fees, I know I'm running out of time. There's an hour, We submit there's an hourly cap on attorney's fees, and I've handed provided the court with a handout which addresses the attorney fees. Yes, if they prevail, they're entitled to attorney's fees. I submit there's an hourly cap. The hourly cap is $150 as mandated by the legislature. Subsection 408.221C provides an award of attorney's fees under the subsection is not subject to commission rule adopted under subsection F. Turning to page 2 of the handout, subsection F states, the commissioner by rule shall provide guidelines for maximum attorney's fees for specific services in accordance with this section. There is a provision in Rule 152.4, which is the third handout, that has a guideline for legal services that deals with hours worked. Subsection 152.4D states the maximum hourly rate for legal services shall be $150 for attorneys and $50 for paralegals. And that's mandated by the rule. If you look at if you apply the statute and you apply statutory construction, if they wanted to exempt the hourly fee, they would have said the commission by rule shall provide guidelines for maximum attorney's fees for specific services, and the maximum hourly rate shall be exempt. They didn't. And by so doing, the hourly rate should still apply. Finally, with regard to one of our points of errors, fees for fees, three different courts, sister courts, have held you cannot recover attorney's fees for pursuing attorney's fees. And that's under Section 408.221. The cases are Vega, Garcia, Tate, Narvez. And the last case, what I submitted in a reply brief, is Manbeck, which was issued March 23, 2011, which again held you are not, in this scenario, entitled to recover attorney's fees for pursuing your attorney's fees. We would request that the trial court's summary judgment, or no evidence summary judgment, be reversed. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. First, I want to express appreciation for the panel allowing us to present oral argument on these issues. As set out in our brief, it is our contention that this court should affirm the trial court's ruling and final judgment in its entirety, both concerning the granting of summary judgment on the basis of the lack of evidence of the common law marriage, as well as the attorney fees that were awarded to Mary Lavender in this case. Given the nature of this appeal, it was my intention today to focus on three areas: the issue of the common law marriage, as well as two issues of statutory interpretation related to the attorney fee issue concerning Section 408.221C. At this time, rather than rehash out all of the case law and facts that were previously gone over in regards to the issue of common law marriage, I would just refer the court to Judge Collier's statement. It's in the transcript of the hearing on plaintiff's motion for new trial, which is attached as tab 4 to appellant's brief, where Judge Collier stated, here, this couple never held out to anyone that they were married. Every document that you presented, they're single. Both have sworn that they were not married and never intended to be, and there's not a single person in the world that can say, this couple told me that they were married. On that basis, we would ask that the court affirm the trial court's judgment, granting summary judgment in appellee Lavender's favor. In regard to, I should ask if the court has any other questions before I move on to another.
Not so quick here, just a minute. I lost my quote from your client about basically she took the ring and said, I intend to be married, and then she turns around and says, I don't intend to be married. Well, go ahead, and as soon as I've lost my highlighting here.
Sure, Your Honor. Sure. The testimony that's set out in Ms. Lavender's deposition indicates that it was her understanding that the presentment of the ring by Mr. Brucia was an engagement to be married. I think she consistently maintains that throughout her testimony. Her testimony further states that they had not agreed to get married at that point. They were going to get married. In fact, she says, "I was hoping that the engagement would end with a marriage." So in that regard, I don't think that the evidence cited to by appellant in regards to the ring issue is more than a scintilla of probative evidence on the element of agreement presently to be married.
Okay. I'm in your brief on page 4. Mary Lavender understood that she and Michael had an engagement to be married. However, they did not agree they were going to get married. Say what?
Well, at that point, I believe what she's stating there is they were engaged, but they had not yet agreed that they were going to be married. In other words, I could see how it presents a bit of a conflict there. But
when she says something like that, then it kind of makes me raise my same eyebrow when then she says, "We had not agreed to be married." I mean, when you make a statement like that and then you say, "We're not married," it kind of raises your...
I think in the context of her testimony as a whole, she is consistently saying and referring to the fact that we did not have an agreement to be married at that point.
Oh.
Presently.
That's fine.
It's consistently in the future.
Okay. That's fine.
Concerning the attorney's fees, is it your position that the last sentence of 408.221C, an award of attorney's fees under this subsection, is not subject to commissioner rules adopted under subsection F, just exempts any hourly rate cap?
That's correct, Justice Walker. Our contention is that the rules, the commissioner rules that are referred to there in that last sentence, encompass the entirety of Section 152.4 at Title 28 of the Texas Administrative Code. That particular section provides the commission rules that provide the guidelines. In fact, that section is entitled Guidelines for Legal Services Provided to Claimants and Carriers. And so it's our contention that the last sentence there encompasses the entirety of Section 152.4.
So what is left of the cap?
None of the caps apply to when you fall into the 408.221C category. In other words, once you've got a judicial review proceeding, none of those caps in 152.4 apply to the attorney fee claims that are allowed to the claimant's attorney. And in fact, if justices will look at the copy of the statute that was provided by appellant's counsel, if you'll turn to the last two pages of that handout actually include Section 152.4. The Guidelines for Legal Services. In subsection A, it sets forth that the guidelines outlined in this rule shall be considered by the commission. Then in subsection B, it says an attorney may request and the commission may approve a number of hours. It goes on to state if the attorney demonstrates to the satisfaction of the commission. Based on that language, it's our contention that the cap set forth in 152.4 apply to those administrative proceedings in front of the Workers' Compensation Commission, not in front of the district court as part of a judicial review proceeding. And so to answer your question, Justice McCoy, none of those caps would apply in this case.
From a practical standpoint, why would there be a difference? What is the difference between your skill, ability, and preparation before the commission vis-a-vis before Judge Fostell or whoever?
That is a good question, Your Honor.
We can just leave it there.
Thank you. In regard, any other questions in regards to the hourly cap issue? If not, I'd like to proceed on to the another issue of statutory interpretation involving Section 408.221C, and that is the issue of a party's entitlement to recover the fees that are incurred in pursuing the attorney fees awarded. A bit of a convoluted issue, but again, what we're looking at here is the fee shifting provision that's set forth in 408.221C. And we can, again, use the handout provided by appellant's counsel. It's in about halfway down that subsection C paragraph where it talks about an insurance carrier that seeks judicial review is liable for reasonable and necessary attorney's fees as provided by subsection D, incurred by the claimant as a result of the insurance carrier's appeal. If the claimant prevails on an issue on which judicial review is sought by the insurance carrier, in accordance with the limitation of issues contained in 410.302. Now, that said, it's our contention that that provision allows for a claimant to recover the attorney's fees that are incurred as a result of the carrier's appealing an issue as part of a judicial review proceeding. And the language "as a result of" necessarily includes the recovery of fees incurred in meeting the statutory requirements for recovery. In other words, once the claimant prevails on one of these claims in the judicial review proceeding, the statute's clear, the carrier is liable for attorney's fees. Now, in order to recover those attorney's fees, the statute further requires, and it's at subsection A, that an attorney's fee for representing a claimant under this subtitle must be approved by the commissioner or court. So it's requiring the claimant's attorney to take yet another step seeking court approval in order to recover those fees that it entitled the claimant's attorney to.
And I don't think you'd want to argue it would be very bad policy to adopt opposing counsel's position, because it could cost you more to get your fees in fees than your fees were worth to start with. So why would you, if it's going to cost you $5,000 in your time to try to collect your $2,500 in fees, why would you even try to collect them?
That's an excellent point, Justice McCoy. And that's
counsel if he has a different.
No, well, I think you've correctly stated appellant's position in this case is that we're not entitled to those fees, and that we have to incur those fees that you're talking about in order to seek those fees. And based upon that interpretation, it renders an unjust result to the claimant. As you're stating, why would a claimant's attorney try to recover any fees if they're just going to be eaten up by the time you're going to have to spend in pursuing them? Now, opposing counsel mentioned three Court of Appeals opinions that have found that the claimants are only entitled to recover those amounts that they incur in prevailing on an issue for which judicial review was sought, and that fees incurred in pursuit of fees are not recoverable by the claimant's attorney. The three cases that opposing counsel is referencing are out of the Dallas Court of Appeals, San Antonio, and the Austin Court of Appeals. I think in those courts' opinions, each of the courts are relying on the apportionment language that's contained within subsection C. It's the sentence immediately following the sentence that I just went over with the court, and states that if the carrier appeals multiple issues and the claimant prevails on some but not all of the issues appealed, the court shall apportion and award fees to the claimant's attorney only for the issues on which the claimant prevails.
You're saying in these cases, the claimant prevailed on some issues and the carrier prevailed on some issues. It was not, you can't recover attorney's fees for attorney's fees.
I don't know if that is exactly the factual posture of those cases. It was just my reading of the cases that those courts were pointing to that specific language in order to reach the holding that a claimant's attorney is not allowed to recover fees in pursuit of fees. They found the language that you recover only for the issues on which the claimant prevails to be of particular importance to them. I would state that is a misinterpretation of that particular provision. I think what that particular provision is setting out is a specific, it's for a specific circumstance. If the carrier appeals multiple issues and the claimant prevails on some but not all, what you do in that regard is, well, you're allowed to recover fees that were incurred as a result of those issues on which the claimant prevailed.
You have to segregate your fees, just like in any trial.
Correct, Your Honor. I think that's exactly what it's saying. And so based on that interpretation, again, we're saying it's our contention that the claimant is entitled to recover those fees that are incurred as a result of the carrier's appeal for those issues on which the claimant was the prevailing party. And so that necessarily, again, includes the recovery of fees incurred in meeting the statute's requirement to obtain those fees. And, you know, I think it's kind of a red herring as well, because you're never going to have an issue of where a claimant's attorney is going to try to seek the recovery of fees on an issue for which he didn't prevail. It's just not going to happen. And so based on that analysis, again, it's our contention that fees incurred in pursuit of fees would, in fact, be recoverable under 408.221C. Are there any other issues before I conclude that I could assist the court with this afternoon? Very well, then. We would ask that the court affirm the trial court's judgment in its entirety as to both the summary judgment granted in appellee's favor as well as the attorney fees awarded. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Norris.
May I please the court? With regard to Justice McCoy pointed out, in one part of the testimony it is, yes, we were married. The other part is, or we agreed to be married. The other part is, no, we don't agree to be married. There's also other inconsistencies that are in the testimony, the summary judgment evidence, concerning disbursement of money from double M vending, no disbursement of money, things of that nature. Also, there is at least the representation that Mr. Brashear was making representation to others that it was our property. We were living there together. It was ours. I think there is more than a scintilla to warrant reversal of the no evidence summary judgment and have a jury decide these issues or three prongs of an agreement to be married, cohabitation, and holding out to others based on all the evidence that would be ultimately admitted before a jury. With regard to the attorney's fees, the most recent decision is Manbeck, and I think the Austin Court of Appeals goes through the statute and interprets the statute following Vega Garcia and Tate, saying that's not what the legislature intended. It's clear. The language says they're only entitled to recover attorney's fees on the issues which they prevail. Otherwise, you get exactly into the scenario that we are in this case, where they submit a bill for $53,000 for a summary judgment, and we have to have a hearing on it in order for the court to hear the testimony or evidence. In those other cases,
and what's the matter with that?
Pardon me?
What's the matter with that? You said we get into this scenario, okay? I'm saying.
Well, they want to be in the situation where they're saying, well, then the carrier can just, you know, say deny, deny, deny. I handle a lot of these cases in district court. I had a case I tried last year, and I just agreed to an order on attorney's fees. There was no dispute about it. If we can reach a reasonable resolution on what's a reasonable attorney fee, then so be it. The problem occurs when you have attorneys submitting fees that are what some may say are unreasonable, unhigh, $300 an hour for a one-year lawyer, things of that nature. And then so you have to have the court decide it. But I think the hourly cap applies. The statute is clear in that I'm mixing apples and oranges here. The attorney's fees for fees, the Vega Garcia case, the Tate, have all held you cannot recover fees for fees. And it's consistent with the plain language of the statute and the legislative history. In fact, to keep costs down in workers' compensation cases, and it's discussed in the Manbeck case. With regard to the hourly cap, the statute is clear, I believe. An award of attorney's fees under the subsection is not subject to commission rules adopted under F. F is clear. The commissioner rule shall provide for guidelines for maximum attorney's fees for specific services. And the reason that he exempted it is, if you look at Rule 152.4C, which is the guideline for specific services, when you're at the Workers' Comp Commission, if you're preparing for a preliminary hearing called the BRC, they only approve 2 hours. Obviously, that has no application in district court. The contested case hearing, they cap it at 4 hours. Obviously, that has no application. What's interesting also is, if you look at 152.4B, it states an attorney may request and the commission may approve a number of hours greater than allowed by these guidelines. Not an hourly rate higher, but more hours if it's a case that's more complicated and requires additional work. The legislature did not exempt out the maximum hourly rate for legal services. It is $150 for attorneys, $50 for paralegals. They haven't changed it since 1991. Believe me, as a defense lawyer, I would like perhaps for them to change it, but the law is the law. When I'm handling a case in Workers' Comp Commission, I'm a 20-year lawyer, I can only charge my client $150 an hour.
Do you charge at $150 an hour for this work?
Sometimes I have to.
Well, what I'm getting at is, isn't it a goose and gander rule?
No, I believe...
It's not a goose and gander rule. The plaintiff's attorney can only get $150, but the insurance company's lawyer can get whatever?
No, I agree. I agree it should equally apply. If the court, if you render an opinion that says under the statute the hourly cap is $150, then the hourly cap's $150. But there is no court... published Texas appellate court opinion addressing this issue. I would request that the court reverse the summary judgment.
I have a quick question. How do we know that the trial court even awarded attorney's fees for pursuit of attorney's fees? It looks to me like the final judgment just awards $24,400 in a lump sum.
And the reason we know that is, as an appendix to the appeal, is a letter from Judge Collier outlining his...
If I may please. Is that the letter where it decreases the decreases the rate, decreases the paralegal?
Yes, and he outlines the hours that he is awarding.
But that's a letter does not constitute findings of fact. Can we even look at that?
It's part of the record. It was part of his basically opinion and reasoning, and he signed it. Now granted, I understand, but it was based on that information on which the numbers that were calculated and submitted for that amount of attorney's fees.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, thank you very much for your arguments here today and for your briefing. It's been very helpful to the court. Your case is submitted, and you will receive an opinion from us in due course.
Thank you.
You're free to leave.
Thank you.